If you disregard the state satanic ritual theory, the entire nature changes.
It starts you thinking, well, maybe we're not looking for these extreme suspects. We're looking for someone who's kind of ordinary, invisible.
So at that point, we thought we should put more funding into further DNA testing.
And we're getting packages and shipments of all sorts of DNA samples that we're then forwarding on to our DNA expert.
Out there was a process that was going on that either would be the impetus for exoneration or would be the state's last chance to demonstrate in this highly controversial case that he was good for it. And Damien's reaction to that was that he was absolutely adamant about the DNA testing.
Of all the samples and all the various hairs and things that got tested, there was nothing. None of the DNA came back. Nothing matched Damien, Jason, or Jesse. What was interesting, however, were some unknown hairs. And there was one hair in particular that was in the binding of one of the ligatures. The boys had their hands tied with shoelaces, and right in the middle of a knot that had been tightened, there was a hair jammed in that knot.
Had the hair been located anywhere other than inside a ligature binding, I would say, you know, it's not as significant as it could be. But given its location, I think it's particularly damning evidence.
The hair that was tied into Michael Moore's ligature had to come from somebody. So over Christmas 2006, we studied John Douglas's report and started to think about who that foreign profile could belong to.
Welcome to the Scarlet Tavern. Grab a drink, take a seat, and let's begin. Tonight, we're diving into one of the most controversial and haunting true crime cases in modern history. A tale of three teenagers, a small Arkansas town, and a decades-long fight for justice. Grab your favorite drink, because this one's going to take us through twists, turns, and courtrooms as we explore the case of the West Memphis Three. Was it a witch hunt, a miscarriage of justice, or something darker lurking beneath the surface? Pull up a chair, dear listeners, because tonight, the truth is as murky as the bayous of West Memphis. This is Scarlet Tavern. All right. So, the West Memphis Three, kind of wrapping up our satanic panic.
I know this one's been one you wanted to do for a while. I've been curious about the case myself.
Yeah.
I admit to not knowing too much. I kind of let you handle this one, since this is kind of what you wanted to do.
Yeah, I've studied this one for a while. I went really in depth a while back with this one. And so I really wanted to do this because it does play into the satanic panic a bit, because as we'll see, the boys in here were involved in D&D and listening to heavy metal and all that kind of stuff. And then that kind of plays into the satanic panic. This was the early 90s, right when it almost right in the heart of that, because you had different satanic panics moving throughout the country. And so you had the big one in like the heavy South, Tennessee, Florida, all of that in the 80s. And then the late 80s, it started to shift through. And then it really, I believe the satanic panic ended like the heavy satanic panic ended like 95-ish.
Yeah, this was actually really more toward the tail end of it. I guess if we're calling it anything, this is kind of like the last hurrah, I guess, of the satanic panic, the supposed moral panic in the United States. By this point, everybody just kind of realized, this really isn't doing anything. This was just kind of the last thing. Most of the so-called experts that we've covered in the previous episodes, most of them have actually been discredited by this point.
So. Yeah. So we're going to kind of bounce around a little bit between the stuff. We'll talk about what happened. We'll talk about the suspects, the investigation, the trials, and then how it ended. because even to this day, we just got brand new news at the beginning of this year. So this is still going to this day. So on the evening of May 5th, 1993, the quiet town of West Memphis, Arkansas, was shaken by the disappearance of 3 8-year-old boys, Steve Branch, Michael Moore, and Christopher Byers. The first distress call came from John Mark Byers, Christopher's adoptive father, at around 7 p.m., reporting the boys missing. Witnesses, including three neighbors, later recounted seeing the boys playing together at around 6:30 p.m. with Terry Hobbs, Steve Branch's stepfather, calling them to come home. However, initial police reports to locate the boys that night were minimal, and despite friends and neighbors joining the search, no substantial leads were uncovered. Now, these boys, they did live near each other, but one other significant thing is they were all in the same Boy Scout troop together. Mm-hmm. They spent a lot of time together, and their dads were den fathers as well, or their stepdads. I believe all three of them have stepfathers. Their fathers aren't
adoptive.
Yeah, their fathers aren't in the picture. So the following morning on May 6th, the search intensified, with Crittenden County search and rescue teams leading the effort. While searchers scoured West Memphis, their primary focus was on the Robin Hood Hills, the last known location of the boys. And Robin Hood Hills is the little subdivision that they lived in. Despite a meticulous shoulder search of the area, no trace of the boys was found until around 1:45 p.m. At that moment, a juvenile parole officer named Steve Jones spotted black shoes floating in a muddy creek leading to a major drainage canal in Robin Hood Hills. What followed was a gruesome discovery that would forever scar the community. The bodies of the three missing boys were found in the creek, stripped naked and bound in a cruel manner, their right wrists tied to their right ankles behind their backs and their left wrists to their left ankles. Their clothing was also found in the creek, some pieces twisted around sticks embedded in the muddy bed. Most of the clothing was turned inside out, and two pairs of the boys' underwear were never recovered. Christopher Byers, one of the victims, had suffered severe lacerations and mutilation to his genitalia. Forensic pathologist Dr. Frank J. Peretti conducted the autopsies and concluded that Christopher Byers died from multiple injuries, while Steve Branch and Michael Moore succumbed to multiple injuries with drowning. Initially, the police suspected that the boys had been sexually assaulted. However, this was later challenged by expert testimony and further evidence of DNA trace amounts, including sperm DNA found on a pair of pants at the scene, only added more complexity to the case. There was also a debate about how and where the boys had been killed. While the police maintained that the murders occurred at the creek, critics argued that at least the assault could not have taken place there. Meanwhile, experts from the prosecution argued that Byers' injuries resulted from a deliberate knife attack and castration, while defense experts suggested these were more likely the results of post-mortem animal predation.
So an animal got to him after.
Yeah, that it's always been the debate because it's kind of hard to tell, especially with them being such small children. I mean, obviously, they don't, without being too graphic, they don't have large genitalia. I mean, it's kind of hard to tell, is this a knife or is this an animal? And with them, they're in bumfuck Arkansas. They are in a creek and
creek.
They're in a creek. And so it's, there's going to be animals there.
Plus water does tend to damage and ruin everything, including the human body. That's why it's very hard to determine, call it time of death, especially in a body found in the water, because it could be, you think it's like, oh, it's been dead fairly for so long, and in reality it's only been a little bit.
And this is springtime. I mean, this is the heart of spring in Arkansas. This May.
A lot of flooding, a lot of water gushing down from the
mountains. Lot of rain. So all that snow from the beginning of the year still melting and coming down. So interestingly, Christopher Byers was found to have drugs in his system at the time of his death. He had been prescribed Ritalin on January 1993 for attention deficit hyperactive disorder, though the autopsy report described the drug as carbamazepine. at a subtherapeutic level. His father later suggested that Christopher might not have taken his medication on the day of his disappearance. So you have, this is the early 90s, so a lot of kids were being prescribed Ritalin, as Ben's raising his hand.
Ritalin is a very low dose. It's very popular because it was able, if you actually had ADHD, it helped you, but you had to take it twice a day, once in the morning, once in the afternoon. And
it kind of helped you focus.
Yeah.
But if you don't have ADHD,
you're
going fucking nuts.
You're basically the human version of the Tasmanian devil.
Okay. So, carbamazepine is actually, it's an anticonvulsant. So it's used to treat epilepsy, neuralgia, manic, and mixed episodes and bipolar disorder.
But that kid,
and that's what was in his system.
But if it was at a subtherapeutic level, that would mean it's at a very low dose, right?
Correct. But it still means that he's taking it, and there's no evidence of him being bipolar, only having ADHD. He was not prescribed this drug.
That is a very strange one.
So it would mean that he was given this drug somehow. So subtherapeutic could mean he was injected with it. So
forced down his throat.
Yeah. So, and the fact that his father suggested he might not have taken his medication on the day of his disappearance, or maybe he could have taken it on his own, seeing a pill that looked, he's at his friend's house and sees a pill that looks like his. Oh, I forgot to take my Ritalin. Let me take this.
Yeah,
it's very possible. I mean,
you almost have to look at the medical history of everyone's family involved and see if anybody's taking it.
Yeah, they're 8 year olds. So you never know.
I mean, like my baby brother, he got, I think it was Ritalin. It might have been something else. If you did not give it to him, he would not take it. You would physically have to put it in your hand. Have him put it in his mouth, and then you'd have to show him that he swallowed it.
Yeah. So these initial discoveries set the stage for what would become one of the most controversial and debated murder cases in recent U.S. history, a case that would become known as the mystery of the West Memphis Three. Now, let's talk a little bit about the victims. You have Steve Edward Branch, Christopher Byers, and Michael Moore. They were more than just classmates. They were best friends and inseparable companions. All three were second graders at Weaver Elementary School in West Memphis, Arkansas, where they'd each earned the rank of wolf in their local Cub Scout pack. These young boys shared a close bond, one that would be tragically cut short. Steve Edward Branch, just 8 years old, was known for his bright blonde hair, blue jeans, and white t-shirt. An honor student, Steve was described as a kind-hearted child who loved riding his black and red bicycle around the neighborhood. Born to Stephen and Pamela Branch, his parents divorced when he was an infant, and his mother later remarried Terry Hobbs, with whom Steve lived, along with his four-year-old half-sister, Amanda. Steve's life came to a tragic end, and he now rests in Mount Zion Cemetery in Steele, Missouri. Not too far from us, actually. Christopher Mark Byers was also 8 years old, with light brown hair and an infectious belief in the magic of childhood. He still believed in the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus, as his mother fondly recalled. After his parents, Melissa DeFeer and Ricky Murray, divorced when he was four, his mother remarried John Mark Byers, who later adopted Christopher. On the day he disappeared, Christopher was last seen wearing blue jeans, dark shoes, and a white long-sleeve shirt. He lived with his adopted father, his mother, and his 13-year-old stepbrother, Sean Ryan Clark. Christopher's memory lives on at Forest Hill Cemetery East in Memphis, Tennessee. James Michael Moore, affectionately known as Michael, was another 8-year-old with brown hair and a zest for life. He loved wearing his Boy Scouts uniform, even outside of meetings, and was often considered the leader among his three friends. Michael was last seen in his blue Boy Scouts of America shirt, blue pants, and an orange and blue Boy Scout hat, riding his light green bicycle. He lived with his parents, Todd and Dana Moore, and his older sister, Dawn. Today, Michael is remembered at Crittenden Memorial Park Cemetery in Marion, Arkansas. In the wake of this unimaginable tragedy, the community of West Memphis came together to honor the memory of these three young boys. In 1994, a memorial was erected at the playground of Weaver Elementary School, where they had all been second graders. For many, the spot serves as a poignant reminder of the innocence lost and the enduring impact on a town forever changed. In May 2013, on the 20th anniversary of the murders, Weaver Elementary's principal, Sheila Grissom, led a fundraiser effort to refurbish the memorial, ensuring that the legacy of Steve, Christopher, and Michael would continue to be remembered. Now, as the investigation unfolded, three local teenagers were arrested in connection with the murders: Damian Eccles, Jason Baldwin, and Jesse Miskelly Jr. At the time of their arrest, Eccles was 18 years old, Baldwin was 16, and Miskelly was 17. Each had come from challenging backgrounds, and their lives before the arrest painted a complex picture of troubled youth in West Memphis, Arkansas. Damian Eccles and Jason Baldwin were close friends, bonded by their shared interest in music, fiction, and their mutual disdain for the conservative cultural environment of West Memphis, a town deeply rooted in the Bible Belt. Eccles had dropped out of high school and struggled with his mental health, spending several months at a mental institution. He had received full disability status from the Social Security Administration. Dr. George W. Woods, testifying in Eccles' defense during his trial, described him as suffering from severe mental illness, marked by grandiose and persecutory delusions, auditory and visual hallucinations, disordered thought processes, substantial lack of insight, and chronic incapacitating mood swings.
Well, he sounds like a delight to be around.
Yeah. Eccles had troubled family background, with frequent visits from social workers and sporadic school attendance. He was also known for a bizarre claim made months before the murders that he gained superpowers by drinking human blood. At the time of his arrest, Eccles was working part-time for a roofing company and was expecting a child with his girlfriend, Dominique Teer.
Oh, that's even better. Good Lord.
Jason Baldwin, unlike Eccles, had remained in school and was recognized for his talent in drawing and sketching. Despite his involvement in minor offenses like shoplifting, he earned high grades and was encouraged by his teachers to pursue graphic design in college. Though Baldwin and Eccles were close, their connection to Jesse Miskelly was more distant. Miskelly, who had a reputation for a quick temper and frequent fights, had also dropped out of high school. While Baldwin and Eccles were friends, they were only acquaintances of Miskelly. This loose association, however, would ultimately entangle all three in the tragic events that followed. But the investigation wasn't solely focused on these three young men. Initially, the West Memphis Police Department also considered other suspects. Two teenagers, Chris Morgan and Brian Holland, quickly came under suspicion after they abruptly left West Memphis for Oceanside, California, just 4 days after the bodies were discovered. Both had histories of drug offenses, and Morgan, in particular, was thought to have at least a passing familiarity with the victims, having once driven an ice cream truck in their neighborhood. You got to keep in mind that this is a small town. So, yeah. We could say, oh, the ice cream truck drives around here. That is truly a coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
The ice cream truck that comes around here doesn't remember everybody.
No.
This is a very small town.
My size of town where it's literally everybody knows everybody and nobody can keep their nose out of each other's business.
For the most part.
Got it.
On May 17th, 1993, Morgan and Holland were arrested in Oceanside and subjected to polygraph tests by California police. The results indicated deception when they denied any involvement in the murders. During questioning, Morgan claimed the history of heavy drug and alcohol use, including blackouts and memory lapses. At one point, he even suggested that he might have killed the boys, though he quickly recanted. Despite the potentially incriminating statements, blood and urine samples sent to the WMPD from California police did not lead to further investigations, and Morgan's recanted statement was eventually barred from being used as evidence in the trials. Which, either way, half of that can't be used because it's a polygraph. Polygraphs aren't admissible in court.
I thought that was recently that they did that with the last.
It's been around for a while.
Oh no, they've always This is why I've never been a fan of polygraphs, because especially back then they were so easy. You could twitch and it could show deception. If you've got,
they're so much harder to fool now.
Now the technology has caught up to be much more sensitive to it. But back then, I mean, this you're interrogating two people, the death of children, and one of them is already an admitted alcoholic and drug user. I guarantee you, he was not the pinnacle of calm and collective during this. So he probably was. I mean, it's still debatable if he was a suspect, but the fact that he showed deception is not surprising.
Well, and I can say this now because the way polygraphs work have changed now, but the old polygraphs, even up till 2010, 2011, I could trick a polygraph if I inflicted pain on myself, like stuck mm-hmm. myself with a needle or something during your base questioning. And that's just basic questioning. Is your name so-and-so? Are you this age? Are you from here? And that's just set a baseline of what your heart rate is. Well, the big thing about polygraph is it measures heart rate.
Mm-hmm.
So if you increase your heart rate during those base questions, when you go back to normal questions and you lie and your heart rate increases, it doesn't go above that baseline. And that's how you trick a polygraph.
So despite the 1988 legal ban on private employers using polygraph tests and the 1998 court decision ruling that their results are inadmissible as evidence in federal courts, there are huge loopholes in place.
Oh, yeah.
No. So federally, it didn't come into a decision until 1988.
Yeah, but that's federal.
There are people who still swear by polygraphs.
I don't either, but back then
police departments thought that they were just the bee's knees and everything.
Well, you got the polygraph and
I'm sorry. I respected the guys trying to grill me for everything, but that guy was trying to trip me up.
So another potential suspect emerged in the form of an unidentified black male later known as Mr. Bojangles.
Oh my God, the racism is just right there.
On the evening of May 5th, 1993, workers at Bojangles Restaurant, located about a mile from the crime scene, reported a mentally disoriented black man in a ladies' restroom. The man was bleeding and had brushed against the restroom walls, leaving blood behind. Officer Regina Meeks responded to the call, but by the time she arrived, the man had left, and the police did not enter the restroom that night.
Okay.
The following day, after the victims' bodies were discovered, the Bojangles manager, Marty King, contacted the police again, suspecting a connection between the bleeding man and the murders. Police then inspected the restroom and recovered a pair of sunglasses thought to have been left behind by the man, along with taking blood samples from the walls and tiles. However, crucial evidence was mishandled. Detective Bryn Ridge later admitted that the blood scrapings were lost. Additionally, a hair identified as belonging to a black man was found on a sheet wrapped around one of the victims. The case of the West Memphis Three was filled with uncertainties, loose ends, and suspects who were either overlooked or dismissed, contributing to the controversy and debate that continues to surround this haunting mystery.
I mean, it's a decent theory, but time and again, investigations that focus on the lone nut theory usually always, it almost never pans out. I mean, there was a case up in Massachusetts. It was one of the Kennedy boys killed a young girl on the Kennedy property, I believe. I forget the name of the case. It was a big one. For years, the police thought it was just some random hitchhiker just happened to have a weapon and just beat this poor girl to death on the private golf course. But it turned out it was one of the Kennedy children who did it. But they steadfastly, no, it's a nut, because no rational person could do this. But what they never took into consideration was that usually of such a violent crime is usually a personal crime.
Yep.
And just what, even with the sanitized version we've told you about these murders, this was a particularly brutal murder. So this is not, it's still within, I think it's still within the possibility a lone nut could have done it, but something like this, if the more vicious, the more personal.
Depending. I mean, because you also have serial killers, too.
That is true. That is true.
And that we'll talk about that at the end, that some people believe that it was actually a serial killer that would happen to be going through. So the investigation into the murders of Steve Branch, Michael Moore, and Christopher Byers was fraught with controversy from the start, with many questioning the methods and focus of the West Memphis Police Department. From the beginning, Officer James Sudbury and Steve Jones felt the crime had, quote-unquote, cult overtones.
Oh, really?
And suspicion quickly fell on Damian Echols due to his interest in occultism. Detective Jones believed that Echols was capable of murdering children, and the police brought him in for questioning just 2 days after the body was discovered.
Oh, boy.
On May 7th, 1993, Echols underwent a polygraph examination where he denied any involvement in the murders. However, the polygraph examiner claimed that Echols' results indicated deception. Then on May 9th, during a formal interview with Detective Bryn Ridge, Echols mentioned that one of the victims had wounds to the genitals, a detail law enforcement considered incriminating since it had not been publicly disclosed. Despite this, police maintain that Echols was not yet a direct suspect, but a valuable source of information. Here's the thing. No, that was not directly opened, but it's a small town. Word travels.
Possibly.
Not possibly.
It does. I'm sure it does, but...
I mean, this guy didn't do it. I mean, we already know that. Yeah. We already know that there's a reason he's not in jail anymore.
This is how a small town works. Joe Schmo? Hey, guys, did you know Joe Schmo smokes? You didn't know that, did you? Mm-hmm. And then he just reaches everyone in the town. So if this guy is trying to hide the fact that he did something, he was doing something, everybody in the town knows he does it.
So as the investigation stalled, police increasingly focused on Echols, interrogating him more frequently than any other individual involved. On June 3rd, they turned their attention to Jesse Miss Kelly, a teenager with a reported IQ of 72, which placed him in the range of borderline intellectual functioning.
This is like Forrest Gump levels.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah,
and despite being a minor, he was interrogated alone without a lawyer or his parents present. Although his father allowed him to accompany the police, he had not explicitly consented to an interrogation.
Those are forms you're supposed to fill out, like, I give consent to you.
Back then, no. Now, yes. Over a grueling 12-hour period, only 46 minutes of Miss Kelly's questionings were recorded. Eventually, he confessed, but he quickly recanted, claiming he had been intimidated, coerced, exhausted, and threatened by police. He later stated he was scared of the police during his confession.
I can believe that.
I can too. Mm-hmm. They're trying to close this case, and they're going to pin it on whoever they can, and they're going to pin it on the stupid kid. Miss Kelly was informed of his Miranda rights, but he claimed he did not fully understand them. Okay, so that right there. I'm going to set some things straight. In most states, there's a few states. I know Ohio is a little bit different, but in most states, you do not have to be read your Miranda rights until you're questioned. A lot of people, you're handcuffing me. You have to read me my Miranda. No, it's not until you're questioned. Now, there are some states like Ohio where as soon as you arrest, you have to read them. But most states, you don't have to read. Now, for those that are out of the country that don't know what Miranda rights are simply the rights that you have as a suspect. So you have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to an attorney. If you cannot afford one will be provided at no cost to you. If you do wish to speak to me, you may stop the questioning at any time and ask for a lawyer, and questioning will be stopped immediately. And then it's, do you understand these rights as they have been read to you? If the suspect says no, you have to then follow up and say, what about the Miranda rights do you not understand? And then they will tell you, and then you are required to tell them.
And Miranda came out in the 1960s, so it's not like these cops would not know. Like, yes. Well, I don't know about that. No, you knew.
Yeah. In 1996, the Arkansas Supreme Court ruled that Miss Kelly's confession was voluntary and that he understood the consequences of waiving his rights.
But if he didn't understand his Miranda rights, then how is he understood that he was waiving his rights?
Exactly.
Unfortunately, and I say this unfortunately, there is still within reasonable doubt, just looking at it from the appeals judge's point of view, that there is still a chance that he just said that afterwards because...
But here's the problem, is we don't know that because it wasn't recorded.
And that is the problem.
Out of a 12-hour fucking interrogation, only 46 minutes are recorded. That is a big problem.
Oh, that is
that's a, when the judge should have been like, well, you guys screwed up.
Yeah.
Oh, no, yeah, absolutely.
It's a massive problem.
That's a massive fuck-up on the cops.
Oh, it very much is. I mean, LAPD handling the OJ case didn't even fuck up this bad. And that's, we're talking about the OJ trial.
Which here. We will probably talk about at some point.
Yes.
Probably later season 3.
Maybe into season 4.
Yeah. I'd say season 4.
Because a lot of the next season is going to be redos.
Part 2.
So... Before the trials even began, get this, portions of Miss Kelly's confession were leaked to the press and appeared on the front page of Memphis Commercial Appeal.
Those cops would have been fucking trash these days.
Oh, now those cops would have been fired.
Yeah.
Easily.
Well, so far, they should have been fired already. Because right now...
That's a mistrial.
Absolutely.
That's a mistrial right there.
I mean, just... But what I'm seeing right now, the cops are going down. They're focusing on these boys for the wrong reasons. But at the same time, I'm looking at it through my lens of like, okay, I'm not a hillbilly. I'm sorry, I don't care about insulting the West Memphis police. You guys have done shoddy work. I'm looking at it through a normal cop's point of view. I still look at these boys. You got one who's got a history of mental illness. The second one, yeah, he's not so bad, but he's probably more the follower of the group. The other guy is too, already is intellectually doesn't seem very sharp as tool in the shed, so he could have probably, in theory, been manipulated. Something happens, who knows? It's a reasonable assumption to question them.
And the thing is, they didn't... Miss Kelly, it's like, seriously, like, you already knew that he was slow.
Exactly.
Like, unfortunately, like, I'm not trying to be rude or anything about it.
It's
but
facts.
Was,
That's it is what it is.
He was on the slower end.
Exactly. That
the cops just literally went after the weakest link.
And even on the thing, though, that's normal investigating. You go after the person you think can confess to you, but you still do it by the book. You record everything. You make sure that they understand what you're doing. Because right now, like you said, it's still, at this point for me, it's very reasonable to think they did that, but already you shot the case. It's like, well, shit, you could have caught them covered in these poor boys' blood, and you couldn't have done anything with it.
Yeah, it should have been a mistrial. So following Miss Kelly's initial confession, police arrested Eccles and his close friend, Jason Baldwin. Despite his lawyer's repeated advice to remain silent, Miss Kelly provided a second statement to the police 8 months later in February 1994, detailing how the boys were allegedly abused and murdered. Miss Kelly's lawyer, Dan Stidham, who was present during the statement, would later criticize the police investigation, highlighting what he believed were significant errors and misconceptions. And we'll actually talk about Dan Stidham later, because he still is involved in this case, trying to prove innocence and prove the cops were wrong. So Dan Stidham is a very good guy. So a very good lawyer. Another key figure in the investigation was Vicki Hutchison, a new resident of West Memphis. Her role became significant after she later recanted her testimony, claiming it had been fabricated under police coercion. On May 6, 1993, the day the victims' bodies were found, Hutchison took a polygraph test related to a theft investigation. Her son, Aaron, was present during the test and became a distraction. Aaron, who had been a playmate of the murdered boys, mentioned that the victims had been killed at the playhouse. When the bodies were later discovered nearby, Aaron claimed that he had witnessed the murders, describing the perpetrators as Satanists who spoke Spanish. His statements, however, were wildly inconsistent, and he failed to identify Baldwin Echoes or Miss Kelly from the photo lineups. Furthermore, there was no playhouse at the location he indicated.
Sounds like
it was. How old was this kid?
8, same as them.
This sounds like he was coached.
He was friends of theirs.
I'm sorry. It sounds like it was coached.
Oh, I'm sure it was.
How was a kid? I mean,
how does an 8-year-old know what a Satanist is?
Yeah.
Furthermore, without being coached.
How does he, if they're speaking Spanish, which again,
how would you know what language?
Well, we don't know if Vicky Hutchinson is Spanish.
Yeah.
We don't know that.
Yeah.
So Aaron
very well could understand Spanish. Yeah, maybe. There is a Spanish population in West Memphis, Arkansas. I mean, it's not a bunch. It's more African-American.
Yeah, it could be his dad also.
Either way, this sounds like a coach thing.
So on June 1st, 1993, Hutchinson agreed to a police suggestion to plant hidden microphones in her home during meeting with Eccles. Miss Kelly introduced them, but according to Hutchinson, Eccles made no incriminating statements during their conversation. Police claimed their recordings were inaudible, while Hutchinson maintained they were clear. She went on to claim that 2 weeks after the murder, she, Eccles, and Miss Kelly had attended a Wiccan meeting in Terrell, Arkansas, where drunken Eccles allegedly bragged about the killings. However, Hutchinson could not recall the location of the meeting or identify any other participants.
That sounds like she's making it up.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, Hutchinson later admitted her statements were false, saying she had fabricated her testimony to avoid facing theft charges and to potentially receive a reward for helping solve the case. So, despite these admissions, she was never charged with the theft, and the role her statements played in the investigation added to the growing belief that the murders were part of a satanic ritual. Basically, what happened with her is she was arrested on theft. And then it was realized that she had a connection to these boys. This was a totally unrelated incident, the theft. Mm-hmm. It was realized that she had a connection, and they said, well, we'll drop the charges if you can get us information on this.
Or she did, or she volunteered it, knowing that she probably knew that they were the investigation, so she probably saw an opportunity. Either way, it's some shady shit.
The police's handling of evidence, questionable investigative tactics, and reliance on unreliable witnesses like Hutchinson contributed to the suspicion and controversy surrounding the case of the West Memphis Three, raising questions about whether justice was truly served.
It was not.
Now, we're going to talk a little bit about the defendants before we go into the trial. Jesse Miss Kelly Jr., born July 10th, 1975, was arrested in connection to the murders on May 5th, 1993. After a reported 12-hour interrogation by the police, Miss Kelly, who has an IQ of 72, confessed to the murders and implicated his friends Jason Baldwin and Damian Eccles. However, his confession contained numerous inconsistencies with the known facts of the case, such as the time of the murders. Due to the Bruton rule, Miss Kelly's confession could not be used against his co-defendants, resulting in being tried separately. He was ultimately convicted by a jury of 1 count of first-degree murder and 2 counts of second-degree murder, and was sentenced to life in prison plus 40 years. Although his conviction was appealed, it was upheld by the Arkansas Supreme Court. On August 19th, 2011, after nearly 18 years in prison, Miss Kelly, along with Baldwin and Eccles, entered an Alford plea. This plea allowed them to maintain their innocence while acknowledging that the prosecution had enough evidence to convict them. The judge sentenced them to 18 years and 78 days, the amount of time they had already served, and imposed a suspended sentence of 10 years. All three men were released from prison that day. Since his release, Miss Kelly has reconnected with his high school girlfriend and were enrolled in a community college to train as an auto mechanic. We'll get a little more into what they're doing now later. Charles Jason Baldwin, born April 11, 1977, also entered an Alford plea on August 19, 2011, along with Miss Kelly and Eccles. Baldwin pleaded guilty to 3 counts of first-degree murder while continuing to assert his actual innocence. The judge sentenced them to time served and an additional suspended sentence of 10 years. He was initially resistant to accepting the deal, insisting that he would not plead guilty to a crime he did not commit. However, he eventually agreed to plea to help secure Eccles' release from death row, stating, "This was not justice, but they're trying to kill Damien." Since his release, Baldwin has moved to Seattle, where he lives with friends. He is in a relationship with a woman who befriended him while he was in prison and has expressed plans to pursue a college degree to become a lawyer to help exonerate wrongfully convicted individuals. In a 2011 interview with Pierce Morgan, Baldwin mentioned that he was working for a construction company and learning to drive.
Unfortunately, unless he can get his record cleared, he may not be able to become a lawyer.
It depends. Alford convictions are a little
weird.
Damian Wayne Eccles, born Michael Wayne Hutchison, December 11, 1974, spent nearly two decades on death row, locked down 23 hours a day at the Varner Unit Supermax. He entered the prison system on March 19, 1994, under ADC number 000931. In 1999, while in prison, he married Lori Davis, a landscape architect who had become his staunch advocate. On August 19, 2011, Eccles was released from prison after he, Baldwin, and Miss Kelly accepted the Alford plea, which allowed them to maintain their innocence, while conceding that the state had enough evidence to convict them. And then after his release, he moved to New York City. So Eccles' mental stability during the years leading up to the murders and throughout his trial was a significant focus for his appellate legal team. They argued that Eccles, who was 27 at the time of his appeal, was incompetent to stand trial due to a long history of mental illness. The appellate records detailed numerous incidents, including a May 5th, 1992 referral by the Arkansas Department of Youth Services for possible mental illness, a year to the day before the murders. Hospital records from 11 months before the killings revealed a history of self-mutilation and bizarre behavior, such as claims that he gained power by drinking blood and that he was inhabited by the spirit of a woman who had murdered her husband. Eccles also reported experiencing hallucinations and a psychotic euphoria during his trial, believing he would transform into a superior entity. His lawyers argued that Eccles had not been mentally competent to waive his rights before his 1994 trial and retained Dr. George Woods, a forensic psychiatrist, to support their case. The defense also presented evidence that his condition worsened during the trial, leading him to perceive court proceedings through a lens of psychosis.
Well, that makes sense. Stress usually exacerbates mental issues.
Yeah.
And a court trial going on trial for killing three kids.
Yeah.
Or not killing, but supposedly killing three kids.
Yeah. And like I said, we're jumping around a bit here just from what we saw. So, while in prison, Eccles wrote letters to Gloria Shettles, an investigator for his defense team, seeking to overturn his conviction based on trial errors, including juror misconduct and a new DNA evidence. A DNA status report filed on July 17, 2007, concluded that none of the genetic material recovered at the crime scene was attributable to Eccles, Baldwin, or Miss Kelly. Much of the genetic material matched the victims, but some could not be attributed to either the victims or the defendants. In October 2007, additional scientific evidence and witness testimony further cast doubt on the original convictions. Eccles' petition for a writ of habeas corpus was heard in the Federal District Court for the Eastern District of Arkansas. And I'm going to skip that part about the release and we'll go into the trials. So their trials became a media spectacle, with each trial adding layers of controversy and doubt to an already convoluted case. Under the Bruton rule, Miss Kelly's confession could not be used against his co-defendants, so he was tried separately from Eccles and Baldwin, and all three young men pleaded not guilty. Now, the Bruton rule began in 1968. It was a Supreme Court ruling in which the court held that a defendant was deprived of his rights under the Confrontation Clause if a confession by his co-defendant was introduced in their joint trial, regardless of whether the jury received the instructions. So basically, the co-defendant cannot name the other defendant in the trial, which is why they separated them, so that his confession would still allow them to have a trial. Because if they tried them all together, one of them would have gotten off. So during Jesse McKelley, Miss Kelly Jr.'s trial, the defense highlighted significant flaws in the investigation and in the confession that led to his arrest. Richard Offshay, a professor of sociology at UC Berkeley and an expert on false confessions and police coercion, testified that the recording of Miss Kelly's interrogation was a quote-unquote classic example of coercive police tactics. Critics of the investigation pointed out that Miss Kelly's various confessions were not only inconsistent with each other, but also with the known facts of the crime scene and the condition of the murder victims. For example, in one confession, Miss Kelly claimed he witnessed Damian Echols raping one of the boys, a detail with no supporting forensic evidence. The police initially suspected that the boys had been raped because their anuses were dilated. However, experts later clarified that dilation is a normal postmortem condition and there was no forensic evidence of sexual assault.
Honest to God, when you have more than one, you should only have one confession when you do that. One confession, and if it doesn't match what you're seeing, like in the scientific evidence, you have a problem. Unless you can prove there is legitimately there is such a thing as a psychotic break, and people can just black out and just do things. But irregardless, if he's confessing multiple times about the same crime, there's a problem. You need to be like, maybe we should rethink this.
Yeah. Despite these inconsistencies, on February 5th, 1994, Jesse Miss Kelly was convicted by a jury of one count of first-degree murder and two counts of second-degree murder. He was sentenced to life in prison plus 40 years. His defense team appealed the conviction, but the Arkansas Supreme Court upheld the ruling. 3 weeks after Miss Kelly's conviction, Damian Echols and Jason Baldwin stood trial together. Prosecution framed the murders as a satanic ritual, pointed Echols' interest in the occultism as a center element of their case. They called on Dale W. Griffiths, who presented himself as an expert in the occult despite having obtained his credentials from an unaccredited Columbia Pacific University, to support the claim that the murders had occult overtones. The jury ultimately found both Echols and Baldwin guilty of three counts of murder on March 19, 1994. Echols was sentenced to death, while Baldwin received a life sentence. During the trial, Echols' defense team argued that any knowledge he had about the genital mutilation of one of the victims could have come from the news reports circulating at the time. Echols himself stated that he only knew what was on TV. Prosecution, however, contended that Echols' knowledge was too precise, particularly since there had been no public reporting of the details of drowning or the extent of mutilation of one victim over the others. Echols countered this claim by stating that Detective Bryn Ridge's description of the earlier unrecorded conversation was inaccurate, and he even accused Ridge of making false statements. Investigative journalist Mara Leverett, author of Devil's Knot, suggested that Echols' information may have come from police leaks or local gossip that had spread throughout the community. The prosecution also tried to question Echols about his past violent behavior, a move that was met with objections from the defense team. However, these objections were overruled, allowing the prosecution to introduce this line of questioning to the jury.
Past offenses that have no bearing on the current case are inadmissible.
Yes.
So he could have been one punch man just beating the shit out of people, but if it had nothing to do with the murder of the boys, it's irrelevant.
Correct. Trials of the West Memphis Three were filled with contradictions, questionable evidence, and controversial tactics, leaving many to wonder whether justice had truly been served or if the young men had become victims of a modern-day witch hunt. Now, there's a lot of criticism on this investigation, obviously.
You think?
The handling of the crime scene by the WMPD has faced widespread criticism, with many pointing out significant procedural errors and missteps. Dan Stidham, a former attorney for Jesse Miss Kelly, highlighted numerous flaws, describing the scene as literally trampled, especially the creek bed. He noticed or he noted that the bodies had been removed from the water before the coroner arrived, compromising the ability to determine the state of rigor mortis. The bodies were left to decay on the creek bank, exposed to sunlight and insects. Furthermore, the police did not contact the coroner until nearly 2 hours after discovering the first piece of evidence, a floating shoe, resulting in a delayed examination. Additionally, officials failed to drain the creek promptly, and any potential evidence in the water remained unsecured until after the bodies were retrieved and the creek was finally sandbagged.
That probably floated right down the creek.
Well, and it's not just that. Even if it didn't, it's degradation of evidence. Yeah. It's water's washing away prints. It's washing away DNA. It's washing away everything. There could have been DNA of the killer in one of the kids' pants, but
there could have been a lot of stuff that was got
washed away.
Washed away, pressed into the dirt, kicked over. Who knows?
Stidham described the coroner's investigation as extremely substandard. He pointed out that a small amount of blood found at the scene was never tested, adding to the list of potential evidence that was overlooked, which I suggest you guys watch these. According to HBO's documentaries Paradise Lost, The Child Murders at Robin Hood Hills, and Paradise Lost 2, Revelations, there was no significant blood evidence at the crime scene, which raised questions about whether the location where the bodies were found was, in fact, where the murders occurred. After the initial investigation, the police failed to control the flow of information and speculation surrounding the crime scene, allowing rumors and unverified details to circulate widely. Yeah, those documentaries are really good. So Paradise Lost is about the initial, and then Paradise Lost 2 Revelations is the follow-up to it. You can still watch them. I highly suggest watching them. They're really good. Investigative journalist Mara Leverett noted that police records were a mess. To call them disorderly would be putting it mildly. She speculated that the small local police force was overwhelmed by the nature of the crime, which was unlike anything they had previously encountered. Adding to the criticism, the West Memphis Police Department refused an unsolicited offer of assistance from the violent crimes experts of the Arkansas State Police. Some critics suggested this refusal might have been related to the fact that the WMPD was itself under investigation by the Arkansas State Police for suspected theft from the Crittenden County Drug Task Force. Oh yeah, a few of them were supposedly stealing drugs.
Probably selling it off on the side.
Yeah. Leverett further noted the mishandling of evidence, including storing physical evidence in paper bags obtained from a local supermarket rather than in standard containers that ensured a controlled and documented chain of custody.
What the fuck? Are they all rookies?
No, they're on a
very small fucking town.
With a very small budget.
Yeah.
Okay, they could have still got Tupperware. That would have been better than just fucking paper bags.
Oh,
well, I mean, we use paper bags for evidence, but they are not handled by an outside source. Yeah. They're not sitting in a grocery store all day.
Yeah, where they could be contaminated, because how often have any of us just, you know, start putting groceries in a bag and then realize, no, gotta take it out.
Exactly.
Aldi.
Yeah, exactly.
So speculation about potential suspects also stirred controversy. The juvenile probation officer present at the crime scene suggested that Damien Echols might be capable of committing the murder, stating, "It looks like Damien Echols finally killed someone."
Jesus.
Such comments, based on personal bias rather than evidence, contributed to the focus on Echols as a primary suspect.
You wanted to get rid of the kid. You could have just busted him for probation or anything. The local law enforcement has proven that they're not above just, you know, doing what they want. So what's a false probation violation, you know, to them?
I mean, you are stealing drugs. Why not just plant the drugs on the poor kid? There you go. Probation violation.
Mm. Yeah.
Not frame him for fucking murder.
In the documentary Paradise Lost 2, forensic scientist and criminal profiler Brent Turvey suggested that human bite marks might have been left on at least one of the victims. However, these possible bite marks were not identified until years later when examined in photographs, well after the initial trials. The first inspection of these marks by a board-certified medical examiner occurred 4 years after the murders. During further examination, experts from the defense testified that the marks were not adult bite marks, while the state's experts concluded that there were no bite marks at all. Moreover, when the bodies were examined by the state's experts, they found that if there were bite marks, they did not match the teeth of any of the three convicted individuals. We know that bite marks will get a conviction. We've seen that in serial killer cases.
Yep.
But isn't it more like, yeah, bite marks will get you the conviction, but it's more that they cast a mold of the suspect's teeth and match.
And usually,
well, yeah, well, but and the reason I said that though, bite marks is how Ted Bundy got caught.
Yeah.
He would not have gotten caught if he did not bite this fucking girl.
Yeah. And plus the fact is that that's why this kind of evidence is tested right away, because the mark impressions can fade. They go away. They can, depending on how deep, and that's assuming they can last longer, but that's assuming someone took like a little, like just a good chunk out of them. This is probably not the case. Let's just pile onto the West Memphis Police Department. They deserve it wholeheartedly.
The criticism surrounding the investigation, the mishandling of evidence, the questionable conduct of the police, and the unverified assumptions contributed to the growing public doubt about the integrity of the case against the West Memphis Three. Now, in May 1994, the three defendants, Jesse Miskelly Jr., Damian Eccles, and Jason Baldwin, appealed their convictions. However, they were all upheld on direct appeal. By June 1996, Miskelly's lawyer, Dan Stidham, was preparing to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. He said, well, if we can't get it through Arkansas, we're going to go through the fucking
Supreme Court.
Yeah. In 2007, Damian Eccles filed a petition for a retrial citing a statute that allowed for post-conviction DNA testing due to advances in technology since 1994. Eccles argued that these new tests could exonerate the wrongfully convicted. However, Judge David Burnett, who had presided over the original trial, denied the introduction of this new evidence.
Of course he did.
The Arkansas Supreme Court later overturned Judge Burnett's ruling on November 4th, 2010, granting a new hearing for all three defendants.
Good.
Now, John Mark Byers, the adoptive father of Christopher Byers, inadvertently became a focal point in the investigation after he gave a knife to a cameraman, Doug Cooper, who was working with filmmakers Joe Berlinger and Bruce Sanofsky on the first Paradise Lost documentary. The knife, a folding hunting knife made by Kershaw, was handed over on December 19, 1993. After returning to New York, Berlinger and Sanofsky noticed what appeared to be blood on the knife. HBO execs ordered them to return the knife to West Memphis Police Department, which they did on January 8th, 1994.
Well, that was smart of them.
Yeah. Initially, Byers claimed that the knife had never been used. When confronted with the discovery of blood on the knife, he stated that he had used it only once to cut deer meat. When informed that the blood matched both his and Chris's blood type, Byers expressed confusion about how it got there. During questioning, the police suggested that he might have left the knife out accidentally, a suggestion which Byers agreed. Yeah. He later stated he may have cut his thumb, but further testing was inconclusive due to the small amount of blood present. Additionally, both John Mark Byers and Chris Byers had the same HLA-DQA genotype, making it impossible to definitively determine the blood source.
That's not weird that an adoptive father and an adoptive son have the same genotype.
Yeah.
That I don't know much. Is that that's
it's rare.
Very rare.
They should be related to have a similar genotype. Mm. And Byers agreed to a polygraph test regarding the murders, which he passed. However, the Paradise Lost 2 Revelation documentary suggested that Byers was under the influence of psychoactive prescription medications that could have affected the test results. He was on LSD. They don't ever say what it was, but So following their convictions, Eccles, Miskelly, and Baldwin submitted dental imprints for comparison to alleged bite marks on Steve Branch's forehead. Oh, yeah. It was on the forehead.
How?
Yeah.
I'm trying to just work the logistics of this. It's like...
No matches were found.
Oh, shocker.
However, John Mark Byers had his teeth removed in 1997 after the first trial, but before an imprint could be made.
Why would you have your teeth removed? Unless you just had bad teeth. My grandfather
had He had a periodontal disease, which was caused by seizure medication. Seizure medication. Remember what we talked about?
Yeah.
But also stated that he had planned the removal because of other long-standing dental problems. Yeah. During a later examination of autopsy photos, an expert suggested that a mark on Christopher Byers' body might have been caused by a belt buckle. Subsequently, John Mark Byers admitted to the police he had spanked his stepson shortly before the boy disappeared, which, whatever, it's the 90s.
If you weren't beat by a belt, you were... You were lucky.
Your parents didn't love you.
I was trying to be nice.
But... In October 2003, Vicki Hutchison, who had played a crucial role in the initial arrest, recanted her statements in an interview with the Arkansas Times. She admitted that every word she had given to the police was fabricated, alleging that the police had coerced her by implying that they would take away her child if she did not cooperate. Hutchison also claimed that when she visited the police station, photographs of Eccles, Baldwin, and Miss Kelly were used as dartboard targets by officers.
Huh.
Yeah. She further contended that an audio tape the police had deemed unintelligible and eventually lost was actually perfectly clear and contained no incriminating statements. Yeah, they were just had their pictures up and they were using them as dartboards.
Wait, I can understand like if it was an actual child killer doing that.
Yeah.
But not your...
But not in where people walk.
Yeah. In 2007, DNA collected from the crime scene was tested, and none of it matched the DNA of Eccles, Baldwin, or Miss Kelly. However, a hair, not inconsistent with that of Stevie Branch's stepfather, Terry Hobbs, was found tied into the knots used to bind one of the victims. And that's the hair that we heard about in the clip we played at the beginning. Prosecutors acknowledged that no DNA evidence linked the accused to the crime scene, but maintained their stance that the convictions were valid. So we don't have any evidence, but we got it right.
Uh-huh.
Further suspicion was raised when Terry Hobbs' former wife, Pamela Hobbs, provided a declaration on May 5th, 2009, stating that a hair matching that of Terry's friend, David Jacoby, was also found at the scene. Additionally, she claimed that she and her sister had discovered a knife belonging to Stevie, a knife she had believed was with him at the time of his death, in Terry Hobbs' possession after the murders. She also noted that her sister witnessed Terry washing clothes, bed linens, and curtains from Stevie's room at an unusual time shortly after the murders. In 2013, new written statements were submitted to the court from two men, Billy Wayne Stewart and Benny Guy, who claimed to have had information linking Terry Hobbs to the murders. However, they alleged that their information had been ignored by police at the time.
Oh, because I wanted to have it at pinning on the three troubled kids.
Mm-hmm. I think at this point, those cops were just they basically had made their bed in the sense of these are the killers. Come hell or high water,
we're sticking to it.
We're sticking to it because, again, back to the small town thing. How are they going to look when they completely miss the mark?
Yeah.
And three kids. Yeah, maybe not the most popular kids in the town. You just railroaded them.
Now, the families of the three victims remain divided over the guilt or innocence of the West Memphis Three. In 2000, Rick Murray, the biological father of Christopher Byers, expressed doubts about the guilty verdicts on a website dedicated to the case. By 2007, Pamela Hobbs, the mother of Stevie Branch, who had also joined those questioning the verdicts, calling for the case to be reopened and for further investigation of the evidence. Later that same year, John Mark Byers, who had once been a vocal proponent of the three men's guilt, reversed his stance, publicly stating he believed they were innocent. I had made the comment, if it were ever proven the three were innocent, I'd be the first to lead the charge for their freedom, Byers declared, adding that he would take every opportunity that I have to voice that the West Memphis Three are innocent and the evidence and proof prove they're innocent. Since then, Byers has spoken on behalf of the convicted men and advocated for justice for both the victims' families and the accused.
Okay, so if they revert everybody, all the victims' families are saying, hey, yo, these guys are innocent, that should be telling you something.
Well, and that's why, that's what starts this new part. In a separate legal development in 2010, Judge Brian S. Miller ordered Terry Hobbs, the stepfather of Stevie Branch, to pay $17,590 in legal cost to Natalie Maines, lead singer of the Chicks, like the Dixie Chicks. Hobbs had filed a defamation lawsuit against the band over comments and writings by Maines implying his involvement in the murders. The judge dismissed the case, stating that Hobbs had willingly involved himself in the public debate surrounding the case. So this was a big thing. The Dixie Chicks had written a song about the West Memphis Three.
Really? Which song?
It's gone now. You can't find it. I don't even remember what it was. But they were forced to take it down. Johnny Douglas, a former FBI agent and prominent criminal profiler, provided another critical perspective. He suggested that the murders were more indicative of a single perpetrator intent on degrading and punishing the victims rather than a trio of unsophisticated teenagers. Douglas, who is very well-versed, served as the FBI unit chief of the Investigative Support Unit of the National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime for 25 years.
Yeah, he knows what the fuck he's talking about.
Yeah. He stated that the evidence did not support the theory of satanic rituals and that postmortem animal predation could explain the alleged knife injuries. He believed the victims died from a combination of blunt force trauma and drowning in a crime driven by personal motives.
As I said, usually the more violent the act or the crime, the more personal.
Typically,
yeah.
The case of the West Memphis Three has inspired numerous documentaries, publications, and cultural projects. Joe Berlinger and Bruce Sanofsky's Paradise Lost trilogy, Paradise Lost, The Child Murders at Robin Hood Hills, Paradise Lost 2, Revelations, and Paradise Lost 3, Purgatory, strongly criticized the guilty verdicts. The films brought widespread attention to the case, marking the first time Metallica allowed their music to be used in a movie. Because Eccles was a big Metallica fan. And Metallica never believed that the kid was guilty. So they allowed them to use it in this movie.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Metallica were a huge part of this. Several books have also delved into the case, arguing for innocence of the three men. These include Devil's Knot by Mara Leverett, Blood of Innocence by Guy Riel, and The Last Pentacle of the Sun, Writings in Support of the West Memphis Three, edited by Brett Alexander Savory and M.W. Anderson. In 2005, Damien Eccles published his memoir, Almost Home, Volume 1, providing his perspective on the case, while Greg Day's biography of John Mark Byers, Untying the Knot, John Mark Byers and the West Memphis Three, was released in May 2012. The case has also inspired numerous songs and albums. In 2000, the album Free the West Memphis Three was released by Koch Records, featuring original songs about the case by artists like Steve Earle, Tom Waits, L7, and Joe Strummer. In 2002, Henry Rollins collaborated with other musicians to produce Rise Above, 24 Black Flag songs to benefit the West Memphis Three, with all proceeds going to the defendants' legal funds. The metalcore band Zao included a track titled Free the Three on their 2012 album Parade of Chaos. On April 28, 2011, Disturbed released a song titled Three with all proceeds going to the West Memphis Three's Benefit Foundation. Additionally, a website created by Martin David Hill serves as a thorough investigation, collating and discussing many details surrounding the murders of the subsequent investigation. Investigative journalist Aphrodite Jones covered the case on her Discovery Network show True Crime with Aphrodite Jones following the new DNA discoveries. The episodes premiered on May 5th, 2011, with extensive background information available on the Investigation Discovery website. Case was also featured on the show Wrongfully Convicted, announced by White Light Productions in August 2011. CBS's 48 Hours aired an episode titled The Memphis Three in January 2010, providing an in-depth coverage, including interviews with Echols and his supporters. The episode was re-aired on September 17, 2011, after the men's release, featuring updated interviews with Echols, Baldwin, and Echols' wife. Piers Morgan Tonight also aired an episode on September 29, 2011, discussing the three men's plans for the future and an ongoing investigation into the case. The 2012 documentary West of Memphis, directed and written by Amy J. Berg and produced by Peter Jackson and Damien Echols himself, premiered at the Sundance Film Festival and garnered significant attention, with actor Johnny Depp, a longtime supporter of the West Memphis 3, showing his support of the Toronto International Film Festival. The case was also dramatized in the 2014 feature film Devil's Knot, directed by Adam Ogoyan and starring Reese Witherspoon and Colin Firth, bringing the story of the West Memphis 3 to a broader audience and continuing to raise questions about the justice served or denied in this tragic case. So there's a lot of media about these.
Yeah.
There's tons. Well, actually, we can watch The Devil's Knot. It's great.
I would like to see some.
It's a good dramatized version of this.
I mean, honestly, the sad thing is, I think this is my personal opinion. I think the West Memphis cops were pretty early on realized they were not going to find who did this. I think even barring all the contaminated crime scenes and everything, I think they realized we have nothing to go on. And except for the fact that this is a fucked up crime scene, and who do we know that is mostly fucked up in the head that theoretically could have done this? Oh, we got Damien Echols, Miss Kelly, and Baldwin. Yeah, two of them have at least been in trouble.
Yeah.
I mean, they all have been in trouble, one thing, but two of them were the worst of it. And they settled on it and they went through it. Because as we've seen, there are other possible things, but possible motives. I believe you said that one of the theory that's recently been going on, because this is due to the recent news of the motion for post-conviction DNA testing, serial killer may have been involved.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that at the end.
And I mean, it really stinks of they just needed somebody to convict, because I think these detectives realize we're going to have to go to the parents of these children and tell them we have nothing. Yeah. Some cases are just cold from the beginning. And I mean, and they have a very slim chance of you catching a lead, and those critical, even first couple hours of discovery are vital to getting that crucial evidence, and they blew it.
Yeah.
They blew it 100%, and they just tried to scramble because nobody was going to go to the press and say, yeah, we got nothing. On top of that, they're already under a cloud for possibly stealing drugs and police corruption. They can't, I mean, coupled with, oh yeah, we can't even find the murder of three small innocent children in our very small community.
Yeah. So, after its release, Damien Echols relocated to Salem, Massachusetts with his wife, Lori Davis, and has stated he has no intention of returning to Arkansas.
I wouldn't.
In a 2013 interview with Piers Morgan, he expressed his desire to pursue a career in writing and the visual arts. Echols had already begun to share his story while in prison, self-publishing his memoir, Almost Home, My Life Story, Volume 1, in 2005. After his release, he continued to work on various media projects, including music, art, and written works. He co-wrote the lyrics to Army Reserve, a song featured on Pearl Jam's self-titled 2006 album. In 2007, he collaborated with Mikael Graves, a former vocalist for The Misfits, to release an album titled Illusions. Echols began creating art while on death row, describing it as a side effect of my spiritual magical practice. His work was exhibited at the CoPro Gallery in Los Angeles from March 19th to April 16th, 2016. The exhibition, titled Salem, highlighted parallels between historical Salem witch trials and Echols' experience, which he describes as a modern-day witch hunt driven by false accusations of satanic ritual abuse. On March 23, 2016, he also gave a presentation about his artistic process at the Rubin Museum of Art. The transcript of Eccles' spoken word performance from The Moth was included in a compilation of 50 stories from the show's archives published in 2013. His poetry had appeared in Porcupine Literary Arts Magazine, and he has contributed nonfiction to the Arkansas Literary Forum. Since his release, Eccles has published a memoir, Life After Death, which details his childhood and incarceration and incorporates material from his earlier 2005 memoir. In 2014, he co-authored Yours for Eternity, a love story on death row with Laurie Davis, who had initially started corresponding with him in 1999 before becoming his wife. Eccles has also ventured into television, providing the voice for Daryl, a Fishman character in episode 3 of the animated Netflix series The Midnight Gospel in 2020. 10 years after his release, in August 2021, Eccles reaffirmed his commitment to seeking out any remaining evidence that could be retested to exonerate him and his co-defendants. In response to his request for specialized DNA testing of evidence since early 2020, officials informed his legal team that the evidence had supposedly been lost or destroyed in a fire, an event for which no public record exists. Following this revelation, Eccles' attorney submitted a Freedom of Information Act request, and the receiving attorney indicated that any evidence testing would require a judge's order. Eccles' legal team filed a motion for declaratory and injunctive relief in the Circuit Court of Crittenden County's First Division and requested an expedited hearing. In December 2021, Eccles' team was able to review the remaining evidence and plan to move forward with new testing. However, in June 2022, a judge rejected a request for DNA testing of the evidence. Eccles' lawyer appealed the decision to the Arkansas Supreme Court in January 2023. The state argued that the appeal should be dismissed because the case was filed in the wrong county, Crittenden rather than Craighead County, where Eccles' conviction was entered. In response, Eccles' team argued that the dismissal was irrelevant since both counties were within Arkansas' second judicial court. In April 2003, the Arkansas Supreme Court ruled in favor of Eccles' appeal for DNA testing. And again, in April of this year, Supreme Court reversed the lower court's order denying Eccles' post-conviction motion for DNA testing on the grounds of jurisdiction, marking another significant step into his ongoing fight for justice. Dan Stidham, Miss Kelly's lawyer, is the one that proposed the new theory that the boys were actually killed by a serial killer roaming America's highways. Now, Eccles has turned into a believer of black magic. In fact, he has written books on how black magic saved his life when he was in prison. Baldwin moved to Texas and co-founded Proclaim Justice, which helps the wrongfully convicted. And Miss Kelly is reportedly working in construction now. Now, that serial killer thing, if we actually look at the importance of West Memphis in Arkansas, it is literally referred to as the midpoint of the U.S. It is one of the largest trucking centers in the nation. So it's very possible that a serial killer, because it's on the west bank of the Mississippi River where I-55 and I-40 meet. So it is in the dead ass center of the U.S.
It's certainly a possibility. I would probably want to read more into what are the facts behind this belief and what's its argument for it. I personally hold to the opinion that this is probably someone way more close to home. Again, never say never, and in this case, anything could have happened. But it's more likely, I think it's more on a purely mathematical basis, it's more likely that somebody who already knew where these kids like to hang out and go and play and everything was likely to find them and do this horrific crime than some random serial killing trucker or traveling along the highway. He just happens to come upon them and he kills them. Again, I want to be very clear. It is possible. It's very possible, whatever, depending on what serial killer that the lawyer is referring to, it is well within the possibility, but it's also more likely that an angry family member was chasing down one of their kids for whatever reason. And unfortunately, the other two boys, well, all of them really, but the other two boys just happened to be there at the wrong place at the wrong time, and they were all killed. As the profiler said, it's more likely that somebody very angry at one of them or all of them for whatever reason killed them, as opposed to three teenagers who probably don't even have any connection to these kids, just happens to find them and just to start to do whatever. Obviously, we all know the satanic occult aspect of this is all bogus. It was just something that they locked on because they already knew the three were already known to the police, and they already knew that they were, you know, odd in that way. I'm using quotation marks for that. Odd.
Yeah. So that's it. That's the West Memphis Three. It's a sad case. I don't know if we'll ever get who the killer is.
Probably not.
But this wraps up our satanic panic, and now as October is quickly approaching, we're going to start moving into more spooky stuff. So we'll be hitting some hauntings and some things like that. We're going to close this out with just a small little snippet of Three by Disturbed.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to thank everybody for visiting the Scarlet Tavern. Please remember to turn in your glasses, push in your seat, and as always, tip the bard. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.